Blog Talk Radio.
The show. It is April 18th, 2017, 8 o'clock on the East Coast. This is the Ant Canary Experience. I am your host, Ant Canary. hopefully tonight we're going to have another great show for you. If you want to call in, call in number is 563-999-3682. And tonight's show, I'm getting over a slight cold, so I'm not to clear my throat too many times. Tonight's show is kind of a personal show. Last week's show, if you heard last week's show was a very emotional show. It was a good show. It was very emotional. It was one of those shows that I can pretty much tell when I have a really good show, it tires me out. And as soon as last week's show went off the air, I went straight to bed because it just exhausted me. If you weren't able to hear that show live, you can always go back, in the archives and listen to it. Tonight's show, tonight's show may be about the same way. Tonight's show is a little bit more personal, even though we're going to be talking about the Tuskegee Airmen. It kind of ties in to a late family member that actually used to work at the museum down in Birmingham, and I'm going to talk about him in just a minute and dedicate tonight's show to him. Yesterday, he died about a year ago. So. I'm going to talk about him just a little bit before we get started in the show. And then we're going to get started in the show, give a little bit of rundown and history of the Tuskegee Airmen. And then I've got some good clips I'm going to play for you. The chat room is open. If you have questions or comments, you want to call in, the number to call in is 563-999-3682. Or if you just want to sit back and listen, that's fine with me. Feel free to do so. So tonight, like I didn't do last week, usually in the shows, if you've been listening, you know that every week I play a little clip about something dumb that Trump has done. And this week I could have played all kinds of stuff. But that clown did this week, but I'm going to skip that for another week. I want to jump right into this topic for tonight. After I play the ad, and we're going to jump right into it. So we will not be hearing another Trump diss this week. So I'm sure you don't mind. You don't miss him. I mean, it's every day he's doing something stupid. So, but I'll probably next week I'll get caught up on doing that. So no problem with that. So what I'm going to do, I'm going to play a clip, and then come back, and then talk a little bit about my cousin. Like I said, I'm going to dedicate the show to him tonight, talk about him and his contribution to tonight's show, even though he's not here with us. Get into that just a little bit, and then we're going to get into the show, and hopefully tonight, like every week when you listen to the show, I try to present information, history for you. They damn sure ain't teaching this in the school. So play the clip. I'll be right back.
February of 1926, historian Carter G. Woodson launched Negro History Week, which later became Black History Month. On the Aunt Canary Experience, we celebrate Black History 12 months a year. Hi, I'm Aunt Canary, host of the Aunt Canary Experience, the show for all things about our history, not his story. On the Experience, we also talk about current events that affect the Black community in the country. So join me every Tuesday night, 8 p.m. to 10 p.m. to get your weekly Black History lesson. You can listen live or call me at 563-999-3682. I talk about topics that schools are afraid to tell our children about. That's every Tuesday night, 8 p.m. to 10 p.m. Please check out the Aunt Canary Experience. Okay, welcome back to the show. Topic tonight is the Tuskegee Airmen. I was going to do this show a while ago, but some things came up between me doing it then and now. Like I said earlier, cousin Tim Sinclair worked for the Park Service, and he worked at the Booker T. Washington Park up in Virginia, and then he, I think he was transferred, or I think that's what he put it, transferred to Birmingham, Alabama, where he worked at the Tuskegee Museum, and he was in all kinds of things at the Park Service. He was at the Million Man March, and then when he moved to Birmingham, he actually was involved in the anniversary of the March on Selma, and even though I couldn't be there with him, I was always, you know, I always kept in touch with him and followed him, and he was doing, so, you know, taking pictures and all that kind of stuff. I mean, it was really cool what he was doing. And the last conversation I had with him before he died, I called him and I was like, you know, actually he's done this show before. When I was only doing the 30-minute version, we did a show. And we talked about all kinds of stuff, and it really wasn't a show. It was kind of like a conversation, because we just had a ball. We just talked about all kinds of stuff, and I wanted to get him on again, so I had given him a call, and I wanted to talk to him about what was going on down in Birmingham and all that kind of stuff. So
He was like, yeah, like, you know, let me check my schedule, and I'll get back with you, and then we'll see if we can put this together. So I'm like, cool. And, you know, like with all things in life, you know, sometimes you, you know, if you got a family, and which he had, and job, which he had, so, you know, we're just trying to, how did Prince put it, try to get through this thing called life. So, you know, we, you know, pretty much in the same boat, you know, just doing our thing. And then before I had a chance to get him back on the show, he got sick. And matter of fact, last year was a pretty, I thought it was a pretty rotten year as far as I was concerned, because a couple of months earlier, one of my other cousins had passed away unexpectedly. So, and he lived in D.C. So I had to drive from here to D.C., went to his funeral, actually had the chance to talk at his funeral. Wasn't expected to do it, but it just seemed like one of those things where I did. You know, preacher asked if anybody wanted to speak, so I got up and spoke in front of a big crowd of people, a lot of people I you know, never seen these people before in my life, but I spoke at the funeral. And, you know, I don't like funerals. Can't stand them. I know they're part of life. I just personally, I just don't like them. So a couple of months later, you know, like I said, you know, Tim got sick. Keeping up with seeing how well he was doing and everything, and like I did for my cousin earlier, you know, like everybody else, I prayed for him to get better. And Tim got better. As a matter of fact, I think the last message I saw on Facebook is like, you know, he was ready to go home because the hospital food was terrible. And I pretty much said, oh, yeah, okay, good. You know, going home, everything's going to be great. Well, everything didn't go great. Took a turn for the worse, and he passed away a couple of days after that. Pretty much told me up. Both of these young men, they were, you know, younger than I am. And they were, you know, they were positive, you know, brothers in that community. And like I said, I prayed for both of them to get better. And, you know, it didn't turn out that way. And, you know, when Tim passed, it's like, you know, from that day, I heard, when I got that phone call that he passed, that's the last day I ever prayed. And that's going to be the last day I ever will pray. So I figured out that, you know, praying is a crapshoot. You know, and these were two young men that didn't, you know, didn't deserve to pass on. I mean, you got people walking around spewing bullshit and hate and garbage, and still walking the face of the earth. And then you got these two men, you know, working, taking care of their families, doing positive stuff in the community, and they got for whatever reason they got picked to go. And I just didn't like it at all. And I was bitter about it. You know, I think I have every right to be bitter. And I just decided from then on out, it's like, you know what? I'm not praying again. And I haven't. So if you know me, you're a family member or a friend or whatever, and anything happens, and you post it on social media, I'm not going to do like other people do, say, you know, I'm praying for you. I'm not going to do that, because I'll be lying. I would just put, you know, my thoughts with you and your family and whatever, which will be true, because, you know, anytime somebody, a friend or family member gets sick, yeah, I'll be thinking about it. But as far as that praying stuff goes, no, I'm not doing it anymore. You know, my thing is, you know, you have, well, for me personally, you know, you have two positive young men that, for whatever reason, you know, they just passed on. And, you know, like I said, you got people out here that ain't worth a damn, and they're still walking the street. And I don't think it's fair. But, you know, that's just me. So, after all that went down, both of their deaths told me up, because, you know, even though we were cousins, we were brothers. Because all three of us, I mean, if you got, and I kind of wish We did, but it's all right. We're going to do it one day, so I'm not sweating it. You know, if you got all three of us together in a room, we all like the same things: video games, comic books, comic book movies, women. I mean, we did not like cousins. We had like brothers, and I considered them my younger brothers. You know, and they were just really, really good guys. And for them to pass on like they did, but you know, it just sucked really, really bad. So, in honor of Tim, I'm going to do this show for him tonight. And as a matter of fact, at his funeral, he had some of his coworkers came and they were going to do something for him. And I thought that was pretty cool. So, like I said, it's just one of those things. You know, it's all a part of life. You just got to get through it the best way we can. And you know, I'm cool with it. I'm cool with it. I mean, there's nothing I can do about it. But I mean, it just messed me up. I mean, I was tore up from both of their deaths for a long time last year. I mean, last year I couldn't wait for 2016 to be over with. But I thought for sure, you know, somebody else was going to go, and nobody did, which I'm glad, because I really hate funerals. And you know, I got up and I spoke at both of the funerals. I felt it was something that I had to do, and I did. You know, there's nothing like speaking in front of a bunch of people that a lot of them you've never seen before. But, you know, and both funerals were pretty much standing room only. I mean, both of them were just full of people. And, you know, and that just, you know, tells me that, you know, when you live in your life, you know, it doesn't matter how much money you make. It doesn't matter how many businesses you build. It doesn't matter how many buildings you have. It doesn't matter about all that stuff. Only thing that matters is you take your life and you take the positive things that positive abilities that you have, and you use those to help other people in your life. Because at the end of the day, you're dead and buried. You can't take none of that money with you. I don't give a damn if you're worth $20 billion. When they lay you in that casket and they drop that casket in the ground, they're not putting that $20 billion in that casket with you. So you can forget that. So what we have to do while we're here, we have to take these positive things that we have been given, and we need to use it and help people around you. And I think that's what I'm doing now. Even though I'm not a professional at doing this, I'm just using whatever ability that I've been granted to do this, to educate our people. And, you know, if it's helping, if it's working, I'm all for it. And so I just do the best I can. We're going to get started in just a second. By the way, while I'm doing this, I've got the TV on A&E, and they're doing a really good couple of specials. And you know, I'm into history. Right now, there's a two-part series, and this is the second part. Came on at 8 o'clock, called Streets of Compton. It's really, I was looking at the first part, came on an hour ago, and the second part's on now, and it's really good. So if you can't watch it, you might want to record it, but it's really good. And then tonight at 9 o'clock, we've got something called L.A. Burning, the Riots 25 Years Later. So we're going to be talking about the riots of 92 in Los Angeles after the Rodney King beating and all that kind of stuff. And I did a show on that a few months ago, so it's pretty cool to see, you know, channels doing stuff like this, because, you know, that's history. A lot of people don't know about it. You know, my kids don't know about it because all this stuff was going down. They weren't born yet. So, you know, it's good to see history, you know, on TV. And I'm quite sure that when they do the riots and they play the clips from the O.J. the OJ trial, a lot of white folk are going to be very upset. But, you know, my thing is, I have no idea what you're upset for. Don't know if he killed those two people or not. I have no idea. I don't know. But I do believe in my heart, and I really believe this, that if OJ, he was married before to a black woman, he's got kids and all that kind of stuff. And I really believe that if those victims had been black, I don't think the white people that got bent out of shape about the verdict with it, you know, I don't think they would have said anything about it. I just think that's just one of those things where they just happened to be white, and all of a sudden they got all bent out of shape, even though people killing black folk just seemed to be some kind of game. So I have no idea why all of a sudden, you know, people are upset. But, you know, it is what it is. So, like I said, that comes on at 9 o'clock. It's a two-hour program. So I've got both of them being taped. I can come back and look at them probably sometime this week. But, yeah, just wanted to give you a heads up on that in case you're interested. So tonight we're going to talk about the Tuskegee Airmen. Not going to do a whole lot of talking. These clips that I picked are pretty cool. I think you will enjoy them. And this, as a matter of fact, this goes to show that, you know, these men, you know, you got to remember, this was back in the 40s. This was back in doing, you know, Jim Crow was rampant. Black people couldn't do a whole lot of anything. Couldn't serve in the military with other white soldiers. You know, I mean, it was just bad back, you know, during that time. And then it was also believed that black people weren't smart enough to be pilots. And unfortunately, some people still believe that because we had a black president, and there are people that didn't think he could do the job because of the color of his skin. I mean, let's just keep it 100, you know. And there were people that didn't believe these men could fly planes and do what they did, and they did it. You know, because you're going to hear in a couple of these clips where people actually thought that black people didn't, you know, their brains were too small. They didn't have the intelligence to do this kind of this type of thing. And they did it, and they proved them wrong. And you know, and also, you know, it pisses me off, not only because of that, but it pisses me off, too, when you have people that get upset about a quarterback taking a knee during the national anthem, and then they want to claim up and down that it's all about the military, which it wasn't. And then they just want to forget that, you know, black people served in the military. And when they came back from wherever they went to overseas, when they came back to here, and I've said this before, when they came back home, they were still treated like second-class citizens. They still had to sit at the back of the bus. You know, they still had to go eat at black-only restaurants. They still had to drink at black-only water fountains. You know, they were still segregated. You know, they were still treated like shit. But even though they risked their lives for this country, it didn't matter. So when people get all bent out of shape and want to pretend that this is some kind of, you know, want to be more patriotic than everybody else, want to be, you know, jump up and down for the military, where it says somewhere, what, Declaration of Independence, I suppose, that all men are created equal. No, not some people, they weren't. So, you know, so just stop that right there, because, you know, these men risked their lives. A lot of these men didn't come back. They risked their lives for this country, for a country that didn't give a damn about them. And they did the job that they were supposed to do. They went to school. They became pilots. You know, graduated, they became pilots, and they did their job. And then when they come back, what do they get? They get treated like shit. And then there's one story I did about blacks in the military. One of the clips, I believe they had some black soldiers in England that were killed because basically the color of their skin. So please, just get off of this, you know, all of a sudden, you know, being gung-ho and patriotic and all this kind of stuff for the military. No, I mean, if you're going to be that way for a military, you know, be that way for everybody that serves. Just don't be just for certain sections of the military because, you know, for some reason you think it's cool. No. So, like I said, so they were African-American military pilots. They fought in World War II. They were the 32nd Fighter Group and the 477th Bombardment Group of United States Army Air Forces. And the entire group consisted of navigators, bombardiers, mechanics, instructors, crew chiefs, nurses, cooks, and other support personnel for the pilots. They trained at Moulton Field, the Tuskegee Army Airfield, and they were also educated at Tuskegee University, which is in Tuskegee, Alabama. The group had five Haitians from the Haitian Air Force and one pilot from Trinidad. Let's see, some things you might not know. Although the 477th Bombardment Group trained with North American B-25 Mitchell bombers, they never served in combat. The 99th Pursuit Squadron, later the 99th Fighter Squadron, the first black flying squadron, and the first to deploy overseas. They went to North Africa in April of 1943 and later to Sicily in Italy. The 332nd Fighter Group, which originally included the 100th, 301, 302 Fighter Squadrons, but the first black fighting group, deployed to Italy in early 1944. June 1944, 332nd Fighter Group began flying heavy bomber escort missions, and in I'm hearing a pinging sound in the headphone. Let's see, where was I? Okay. But the group deployed to Italy in early 1944. In June 1944, the 332nd Fighter Group began flying heavy bomber escort missions. And in July 1944, the 99th Fighter Squadron was assigned to the 332nd Fighter Group, which then had four fighter squadrons. Well, they were also called the Red Tails because the noses of the P-51s that they flew, and the rudder was also painted red, and that's why they had that nickname, the Red Tails. They flew North American P-51 Mustangs. As a matter of fact, I think they've got one at the Air and Space Museum in D.C. Trying to remember if they do or not. I think they'd have to look that up and see if they have one. They may have one. The Tuskegee Airmen were the first African-American military aviators in the United States Armed Forces. During World War II, black Americans in many U.S. states were still subject to Jim Crow laws, and the American military was racially segregated, as much as the federal government. The Tuskegee Airmen were subject to discrimination both within and outside the Army. So they got it both ways, you know. So please don't, you know, don't insult my intelligence with a lot of BS, you know, as far as the military goes. But these, I'm not going to read a lot of this because a lot of the information is in the clips, and the clips are really, really good. These are, you know, you have to give it to these men because, you know, they didn't have to do what they did, and they did, and they did a hell of a job, because I think without their help, I think a lot of, you know, a lot of the, you know, when we won the war, you know, these men, they did what they were supposed to do, and they did a damn good job of it. Let's see, find some more interesting stuff, and then I'm going to play the clips because I think the clips are really good. I'm trying to make sure I don't forget anything. if I do forget something, then I'll bring it up. Matter of fact, one of these clips I'm going to play, I think, let's see, I'm trying to see if I can describe how it is. Way back in the day when they had black and white film, especially at the movie theaters, they didn't do, you know, when you go to the movies now, they'll play previews of other movies, stuff like that. But back in those days, they would play cartoons, and then they would have like news clips. And one of the clips I'm going to play tonight is a 1949 news clip of the Tuskegee Airmen, which coincidentally was narrated by former President Ronald Reagan. And it's like I said, it's 1949 clip. It's pretty interesting. But they did what they were supposed to do. And I want to, if I get a chance, I want to try to get down to Alabama and get to the museum. And they made movies about the Tuskegee Airmen. Matter of fact, the clip I'm going to play later is entitled "Wings for This Man." 1945, not 1949. Sorry about that. See what's going on with this. Oh, okay. That was my phone making those funky noises. What else? The Tuskegee Airmen was a 1995. That was a movie. The History Channel had a documentary called The Tuskegee Airmen. Matter of fact, you might remember the G.I. Joe action figures. They had a Tuskegee Airmen doll. Books were written about them. There was even an episode of The Boondocks that had a Tuskegee Airmen in it. There's a movie called Red Tails, came out in 2012. Let's see. So they did get their props, which is good, which is really good. But like I said, it's one of those things. It's one of those stories in history that, you know, hardly ever talked about. But it's important that we know, you know, keep that history going, because it is very important. If you want to call in, number to call in is 563-999-3682. 563-999-3682. But if you don't want to call and want to listen and just have this be a history lesson, that's fine with me. That's fine with me. So we're going to play the first clip, which is entitled Red Tails. And it's, like I said, all these clips are really good. Let's see if I can find. All right. So we're going to play this first clip entitled Red Tails. And as soon as it's over, we'll be right back. Talk a little bit more, play some more clips. Be right back. That didn't go like I wanted it to. Oh, crap. Okay. Having a technical issue with that clip, unfortunately. Okay, so we're going to go to the next clip. show must go on. So this clip is a documentary entitled Tuskegee Airmen, and it gives, like these other ones, like this one was supposed to, information on Tuskegee Airmen. I'll play this and be right back.
When we came under your command, Colonel, you stated very clearly that we would never find Negroes who could pass a pilot's exam, make it through flight school, survive basic combat.
We've done all of that.
I don't believe your boys have scored a single aerial kill.
It's damn hard to shoot down the enemy 100 miles behind the front line.
What we do, how well we do it, does it matter?
And you all thought what?
You'd sign up, and that'd be the end of 100 years of bigotry. Get your head up, son. You're fighter pilots.
We have a right to fight for our country, the same as every other American. We will not go away.
I can't afford the kind of losses my bombers have been suffering. Can you help save lives?
If you get us new planes, we can help your boys.
Nothing's difficult.
Everything's a challenge.
Through adversity to the stars.
From the last plane to the last bullet to the last minute to the last man, we fight.
We fight.
We fight.
We fight.
We fight.
We fight.
At all costs, you protect the heavy.
Titus, 4 o'clock. Stay with the bombers.
One bomber, that's 10 men. We count our victory by the bombers we get to their target. By the husbands we return to their wives. By the fathers we get back to their children.
Come on, Junior, fail!
It all started when a letter was sent to Booker T. Washington. The letter came from a man in Tuskegee, Alabama, asking for someone to take charge of a normal colored school. Booker determined to create a school of an imitation of New England education. The school opened on July 4, 1881. Booker believed that these people needed an education that would involve an industry they could take back to the plantations and teach to the people needing it there. He not only taught the value of agriculture and domestic work, but construction as well.
Jim Crow laws prevented African Americans from learning to fly in the United States. Many United States military leaders believed that African Americans lacked sufficient bravery, intelligence, and discipline. Senior Master Sergeant talks about Jim Crow laws in the military.
There's a difference between racism and segregation. See, when I came along, it was Jim Crow. And Jim Crow is a hard subject with those people who got planted in their mind that blacks are not equal to whites. I was in the military in 1942, and they didn't start the integration until 1949. I was at the end of World War II. They didn't integrate the Air Force. They integrated us into the Air Force. Congress did a study on the African-American soldier, and they said he was lazy, he had a small brain, and he couldn't do high-tech work.
Lieutenant Colonel Bill Holloman says, "We started out in 1941 as an experiment because the War Department didn't believe we could fly. Didn't think we were smart enough, that we didn't have the coordination."
Until very recently, Negro servicemen were not allowed to learn how to pilot an aeroplane. However, last year, I had the opportunity to visit Tuskegee Institute in Alabama. At my request, I was taken on a flight by Chief Anderson, the first colored gentleman to earn his pilot's license. I can confirm that the training these pilots receive is every bit as rigorous, and they are every bit as capable as any white pilot.
The Civilian Pilot Training Act of 1939 sponsored African Americans with flight training. The Civilian Aeronautics Association authorized schools such as Tuskegee Institute and Howard University to offer civilian pilot training in case of emergency. Tuskegee Institute received certification towards being a dominant flying school on October 15, 1939 by the Civilian Aeronautics Association. In July 1940, the Civil AA allowed Tuskegee Institute to provide advanced civilian pilot training courses. On February 1941, Tuskegee Institute received certification to provide advanced flying courses. The requirements to enter the Tuskegee Institute Ground School were he had to be between the age of 18 and 25, be a full-time enrollment, and a United States citizen. Lastly, you would have to have your parents' permission and pass the CAA physical. Young African-American men wanted to serve their country. In doing so, they wrote letters to the NAACP, War Department, and the President as their attempts to be in the Army Air Corps. In order to apply for the United States Army Air Corps, the candidate must be unmarried male citizens of the United States, between 20 and 26, inclusive individuals who have satisfactorily completed at least one-half credits required for a degree at a recognized college or university, or who can pass an examination covering such work, of excellent character, and of sound physique and excellent health. Significantly, color and religion was not involved in the joining. On January 16, 1941, the Air Corps was open to African Americans. Once word was out that African Americans were eligible to join the Air Corps, requests for application flooded the War Department office, the Army, and the NAACP. Qualified young men from every black college, single of age, and many with some aviation experience were anxious to fly. Since Tuskegee Institute was the chosen place to teach the students ground and flight training, an airstrip was needed. Approved by the Civil Aeronautics Authority on October 15, 1939, in a quick 6 months, the once large land of farm near Tuskegee now became an airstrip. The military established appropriation bill of 1942 gave out almost $2 million into constructing the Tuskegee Army Airfield. Charles Alfred Anderson was the first African-American to have a pilot's license. Anderson contributed to the civilian pilot training program as a flight instructor. Charles Anderson flew First Lady Eleanor Roosevelt over the Alabama skies for approximately an hour. This success proved Mrs. Roosevelt that white Americans were not the only pilots that were good, resulting Miss Roosevelt persuaded her husband, Franklin D. Roosevelt, to use the 99th Pursuit Squadron in combat missions. General George C. Marshall, the Army Chief of Staff, wrote, "Segregation is an established American custom. The educational level of Negroes is below that of whites. The Army must utilize its personnel according to their capabilities and experiments within the Army in the evolution of social problems that are fought with danger to efficiency, discipline, and morale." The 99th Pursuit Squadron was that all-American squadron in January 1941 through the War Department. On March 15, 1941, the Office of the Adjutant General activated the 99th Pursuit Squadron at Shante Field, Illinois. After training, the 99th Pursuit Squadron turned into the 99th Fire Squadron in May 1942. The Tuskegee Airmen in the squadron flew bomber escort missions over Europe and North Africa, not losing any planes. The 99th Squadron, when fully developed, would have more than 33 pilots, 64 commissioned officers, and 474 enlisted men. There would be crew chiefs and shopmen, such as wielders, armorers, mechanics, propeller experts, painters, electricians, dispatchers, and parachute repairmen. The paperwork was done in flow by clerks and typists. Life at Tuskegee was hard. Military policies of segregation necessitated construction of a separate base that was not yet completed when the first personnel arrived. The men were forced to live in tents until the barracks were completed. Although the Army Air Corps attempted to establish a training facility at Tuskegee Army Airfield that was separate but equal, facility, there was nothing equal about it. Making the problem worse, the trained pilots had to stay at Tuskegee for a certain amount of time. An original member of the original 99th Fighter Squadron, Lewis R. Purnell, recalled a regular day of training. "A perfect example of a cadet that was scheduled to fly. We'd all go down to the flying line in formation and stand before our instructors. The instructors would say, 'Come out and tell you, Aviation Cadet Lewis Purnell, we're going to fly up 10,000 feet, and we will perform loops, slow rolls, etc.' My instructors would say very little during instruction, but they were strict. When you came down there, there was no exchange of words. He had a little slip in his hand, and so many errors would amount to a pink slip, and so many pink slips, then you're out."
Double V victory was for African Americans fighting racism, and also the Italian, German, and Japanese enemies. July 26, 1948, President Harry S. Truman signed Executive Order 9981, which stated, "It is hereby declared to be the policy of the President that there shall be equality of treatment and opportunity for all persons in the armed services without regard to race.
The same order called for the creation within the National Military Establishment of an advisory committee to be known as the President's Committee on Equality of Treatment and Opportunity in the Armed Services, which he authorized to examine the rules, procedures, and practices of the armed services to determine in what respect such rules, procedures, and practices may be altered or improved with a view to carrying out the policy of this order. While the order did not specifically mention the words integration or desegregation, that is what resulted.
Okay. Just pause that. That's over. So not only did these men have to fight the enemy overseas, they had to fight the enemy here. So they had it. So they called it on both sides. So they still got the job done. Proved that they were smart enough, just like anybody else, to do this job. And we still fighting that same battle today, because some reason people think that black people aren't smart to do a lot of the things that we do, and we all know that's straight up bullshit. Okay, Brother Maurice is on the line, so I'm gonna let him jump into the conversation. What's up, Brother Mo? What's going on?
Peace and blessings, Brother Anthony. You're doing pretty good and yourself, big brother.
I'm hanging in there.
Praise be to Allah. So are we talking about the Tuskegee Airmen?
Yep, that's what we're talking about tonight.
Praise be to Allah. You know, when I was listening to the clip that you were just playing, and I was going back in my mind about what he was saying, you had to fight the enemy, then you had to deal with the color issue. And, I asked myself, could I serve back then under those conditions? Could I do that? I served in the military out of high school. I went straight from high school straight into the military. And I'm going to be very honest. The military, there's nobody that I know of that went into the military and stayed a bit that came out the same. You're definitely different mentally, emotionally. You're definitely different. You're not the same. They were saying that you should give all ex-military people weapons and let them walk around with weapons. That wouldn't be the smartest thing to do. It wouldn't be, because they will blow your ass away and not even think twice. Seriously, that's why I'm in the nation. So I'm glad we're not permitted to carry guns, because if I was, there would be dead people. There really would be dead people that got on my nerve, and they'd have been out of here. So it's a real good thing that, we're not permitted. But to serve a country like America, and then you're sitting there and you see that they are treating the white Germans better than they treating their own soldiers that's there that's supposed to be fighting the Germans. Mm-hmm. The Germans could sit up front while the niggas had to ride in the back. It's a German prisoner. He getting more respect than the brother. And there's no way in the world that that's the right thing to do, that that's, even halfway acceptable. But those are the things that we had to suffer just to show that we're just as American as white folks. Now I don't know, like I said, I don't know whether that was right or wrong, but, it is what it is. They did serve, and not only did they serve, they served better than the white folks. The white folks, they were getting in their planes and turning around and, not completing the mission. And some of the generals had to say, if you turn your plane around, you will be shot. You will be shot, because they didn't they didn't want to fly in those hostile territories because people was being shot down. So, you know, you just have our people have went through a lot to be able to say that, you know, this is our country, or, you know, we have served, or, you know, we are Americans. You know, we've taken a lot to help this country to reach heights that it would have never reached without us, that it would have never reached without us. And I don't think America really, truly, I don't think the common everyday white person or black person or Asian or Indian understands what black people have contributed to this country that made this country the best country on the planet. It didn't get there by, you know, just white people. We helped. We pushed. We fueled that. We fueled that. So, you know, when your best friends say, make America great again, that'll never happen. That'll never happen unless white people get the hell out. And with that, I'll rest my mic.
Yeah, I mean, that's the question I still ask to this day. You know, when was America ever great? And I still haven't got a response because nobody can answer that question. Because, you know, America, what kills me, you know, when I read stories about this, you know, it's like, you know, the country is where it is today, but then they don't, you know, people don't want to give credit to the people that got this country to this point. You know, all of a sudden, I mean, they just think that we got this way by, you know, osmosis, that everything in this country, you know, white people did it, you know, and that's not even true. You know, I can go back mm-hmm. and history shows, you know, black people built this country from the ground up. A lot of people don't want to accept that, but that's too bad. That's just the way it is. That's history. That's proven history. You know, and I'm like you. I don't know if I could have served this country with the way that these soldiers were treated. I mean, you know, the thing that bugs me is like, you know, the country, come on, you know, volunteer, fight for your country, you know, and this country, you know, and they volunteered and they did the job and then they still got treated like shit when they came back, you know, mm-hmm. and that's the thing that irks me. I mean, it irks me. I mean, to no end that, you know, they you know, they risk their lives, they come back, they still got to sit at the back of the bus. They still got to get their food back door to restaurants. You know, they still can't travel around this country without you know, the opportunity. You know, not opportunity, but the you know, having the thought of whatever of being lynched because you just happen to be black in the wrong part of town. I mean, it's just. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's. Sucks. It really sucks. And then the people, some people around today, you know, they you know, hollering military, because they mad at a football player takes a knee. But you know, people can be military all they want, but you know, be the entire military. Just don't be pieces of it. You know, and our brothers and sisters that serve, you know, they get treated like shit. You know, and it, I don't know if I could have done. You know, be honest with you, I don't think I could have. I don't think. I mean, I could be wrong. I don't know. But it just sucks that the way these people were treated. You know, when the country came begging, please help us. And then when they do it, then you know, they get, you know, they get what they get out of, and then like, man, okay, we don't need you anymore. You know, they couldn't get when they couldn't. Take advantage of the GI bills and all the benefits, you know, that came to the white soldier. You know, these black soldiers, they couldn't take part in those type of things. That's why you got jacked up neighborhoods and all that kind of stuff because of stuff like that. People don't want to give them credit, you know, which is really, you know, really, really, really sucks. But they went out there and they did the job that these people didn't think they could do, and they did it.
Mm-hmm.
There's no denying that they didn't do it because it's history. It's recorded. And they did it. And, It's just really banged up that, you know, you still got people walking around with that same stank ass attitude that, you know, black people can't do certain things because of the color of their skin, you know, and it's really, really banged up, really banged up. So, you got to give these men their props because, you know, like I said, they call it both sides. They call it both sides. And, you know, early in the show, like I said, I probably should have done this a while ago, but, you know, I'm glad I'm doing it tonight because, it fell right into place. So it's all good. It's all good. That first clip I was going to play, it's not going to work, so I'm not going to be able to play that one. So we're going to keep this rolling. The next clip I'm going to play is entitled Tuskegee Airmen, Black Men Can Fly. Because, unfortunately, back in those days, they didn't think black people could do a whole lot of anything. But I'm going to play this. This is a short clip, so I'm going to play this clip. Be right back.
In 1942, an African-American gentleman by the name of Raymond V. Haysbert joined an elite group of black men known as the Tuskegee Airmen. A few months earlier, the United States had been plunged into a global conflict known as World War II. Simultaneously, African-Americans were waging a war for acceptance into the racist and segregated military. These men fought for the opportunity to prove that they had the skills to become the best. Along with their fight for acceptance into the military, the Tuskegee Airmen bore the weight of African-American status in society on their shoulders. The circumstances of the day allowed for a narrow window of opportunity for a select group of black men to face down the global enemy, and in turn inspire a president, a race, and a nation to confront the domestic enemy and racial discrimination.
Well, I think that African Americans had a long history responding to battle, starting from the Civil War, you know, Crispus Attucks, the 9th and 10th Cavalry, and the charge of San Juan Hill, the Buffalo Soldiers. They all served with honor and distinction.
In previous wars and conflicts, African Americans were considered second-class citizens based on the separate but equal doctrine. By the end of the 1930s, blacks were no longer willing to deal with being put down socially and used the military as a vehicle for their protests, voicing their objection to the discriminatory treatment and segregation. Due to the strong efforts of black organizations and the media, the federal government was urged to take action. In 1940, President Franklin D. Roosevelt ordered the Army Air Corps to build an all-Negro flying unit. The African-American community viewed this as their opportunity to prove themselves worthy of being just as good as any other man in America. But in reality, they had to be twice as good as the white man to succeed. Although the NAACP and other black organizations were determined not to accept any kind of segregation, they had to admit that Tuskegee was, nonetheless, an opportunity for the black man to fly.
In September 1940, Congress passed an amendment to the Selective Training Services Act. Many African Americans answered the call for various reasons. One man in particular, Raymond V. Haysbert, was eager to serve his country.
We wanted to fly like everyone else. And the situation in World War II is the entire world was at war. It was 160 nations. People were, food was rationed. This was no Iraq. Food was rationed. We had 5,000 people get killed a day on one island. And so, since it's my country, I stood up.
The training was rigorous, and only the best of the best would succeed. The Army made it very difficult for the Tuskegee trainees to pass the test. The black cadets were given 15 weeks of primary training.
We went through the standard basic Army training. First, they tested us for our intelligence. Then, of course, they helped make the assignments based upon our intelligence. And then we began the rigorous training in mathematics and through the mechanical arts in terms of the engines, the motors, meteorology, because we had to figure when we were flying what effect the weather was going to have and what is subject to happen.
The first class to graduate in 1942 consisted of five people, while the second only had three to graduate.
They didn't want us to succeed. In fact, the first class was five people, and the second graduated three people. And we laughed when we talked about that because they were saying that we passed too many the first time, so we're not going to pass that many the second time.
However, by 1946, 992 pilots had graduated from Tuskegee. Before the trainees could even touch a real plane, they had to learn their flight manuals from cover to cover to ensure safe flying and operational efficiency. Trainees spent hours learning flight maneuvers in a link trainer, which was a little more than a plywood box. The men were also taught to understand the mechanical aspects of their plane. Detailed records were kept, documenting the progress of each flight student, similar to a report card. In addition to their academic grades, pilots received pink slips for any offense of the rules. Three pink slips meant expulsion from the program.
The facilities provided by the military were the bare minimum. The airfield built at Tuskegee Institute consisted of two grass landing strips and accommodated eight planes, all at the cost of $22,900. Houses weren't built until June 1941. The 13 classes that came before were housed on the campus of Tuskegee Institute. Their barracks was the old bathhouse at the renovated Tulps Hall, and they ate their meals in a private dining room at Tompkins Hall.
Facilities were standard Army barracks. Where we ran into segregation on it was the fact that we were a separate Army. Instead of going to the officers' club where it was all nice, you know, and cozy, we had to just get some barracks and put some chairs in there and say, this is your club.
The military believed that African Americans were not mentally capable of flying. Thus, the planes that the Tuskegee Airmen flew were substandard. The pilots perfected their skills in the P-40 planes that they were provided. The plane was slower, but easy to maneuver. Because the pilots became so accurate, they were banned from practice to save targets. The servicemen also perfected their skills changing engines in one-third of the required time. They had to be the best. Although African Americans were becoming closer to reaching their goal to fly, segregation and discrimination of American society stood in their way. The first black unit to see battle was the 99th Fighter Squadron. They were shipped to Morocco. The first real combat they faced was June 9, 1943, on a bomber escort to Pantelleria. The squadron performed under the leadership of Lieutenant Colonel Davis until September, when he was ordered to take command of the 332nd Fighter Group. From the 96th Air Service Group, Hayes Burt joined the 332nd Fighter Group and was shipped out to Bari, Italy. The 99th and 332nd fought in over 200 missions and lost very few bombers. 450 pilots served overseas in either the 99th or 332nd. The airmen destroyed over 260 enemy aircraft, sank one enemy destroyer, and demolished numerous enemy installations. Several aviators died in combat. The airmen became known as the Red Tail Angels, because they painted the tails and noses of their planes red and rarely lost any bombers. Bomber groups often asked for the Red Tail escorts, not knowing that they were black.
The airmen not only served their country valiantly against the Axis powers, but also served their race by overcoming the adversity of segregation in a racist military in America. In February 1948, President Truman sent recommendations from military leaders and his Civil Rights Committee as a proposed civil rights bill. This was very controversial to Southern legislators. Congress refused to act on the bill. On July 26, 1948, President Truman invoked his power as Commander-in-Chief by issuing Executive Order 9981, which stated, "There shall be equality of treatment and opportunity for all persons in the armed forces without regard to race, color, religion, or national origin."
the Tuskegee Airmen succeeded in breaking the color barrier in the military. After the war, blacks and whites were afforded the GI Bill in which they could enhance their education. Thus, many men, such as Raymond Haysbert, pursued graduate studies at institutions such as Morgan State University, Johns Hopkins University, and University of Baltimore, and went on to become a successful businessman. His experience in the military prepared him for his future in the corporate world. These men had set the standard for their race. Ray Haysbert and the other Tuskegee Airmen proved to be role models to future reformers in the ensuing decades. But most of all, these men succeeded in proving to our president, a race, and a nation that black men can fly.
Okay, and there was one part in this that she said that, you know, back then they had to do, they had to be twice, you know, they had to be twice as good as the, you know, and I think a lot of still today, they had to be twice as good as the white man in order to do the same job. And unfortunately, we're still doing the same thing today. Looks like we got Brother Miko on the line. What's up, Brother Miko?
What's up, black man?
What's up, man?
Not much, man. Yeah, I heard you talking about the pilots there. You know what I was thinking, man? You know, even in situations like that, when you talk about reparations, yeah, how do you calculate that? You know, with them doing that type of how do you calculate that type of discrimination, and what it, you know, how it set us back. You know, you look at any area, you know what I'm saying? Banking. I mean, they did a number on us in every area. So how do you calculate that, man? That's just,
yeah.
That's crazy.
Yeah, it is. It is. Cause you know, I mean, it's like every turn, you know, whenever you wanted to make a left, they were there, they blocked you. And you want to double back and you know, take another turn, they blocked you. So, and then, you know, and then to them, I mean, there's no big deal to them, you know. They didn't care. They didn't care. And these men, you know, went out, you know, I mean, and then one of the other, you know, first clip, you know, they did a study that came back and said that black men didn't have the intelligence to do to be pilots. I mean, and they believed that. You know, they believed that, you know, black men had small brains. You know, it's just stupid stuff like that, you know. That they say stuff like that, and then they wonder why you get mad when you hear something like that. And they're like, why are you mad? Why do you think? You know, when people make stupid comments like that, why do you think black people get mad about stuff like that? You know?
Right.
I'm supposed to say my brain is smaller than yours because I just happen to be black. That makes no sense. That makes no sense
at
all.
Right.
You know?
And that's what I say, man. If you got... It's such an easy case to make for reparations, man. You know, you can just look throughout the history. It's an easy case to make for reparations. But like you said, we don't know about it, and even most white folk, you know, they don't know about it either. So
right.
They feel like you don't deserve it. But.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And as a matter of fact, while we're speaking, I've got the TV on A&E, and they're doing a special on the riots, the L.A. riots. And they just show most of the clip when Rodney King got beat in the street. You know, I'm sitting here looking at this. While I'm talking about this and I'm watching this, I'm sitting here bugging because, you know, I remember when all that stuff went down. And, you know, they damn near beat this man to death in the middle of the street and had it on video.
Yeah.
And these guys still got off, you know. And they still do that to this day.
Yes.
And they still do that to this day. You know, they got proof that, you know, and they, you know, and they haven't got to the OJ trial yet. But you know what happened when that happened. You know, they haven't got to that part yet in the show. But you know, they just showed him getting beat down in the street and got it on video. And it's like, nah, you know, you didn't see what you thought you see. You don't see what you see.
Yeah.
You know. still dealing with this stuff today. You know, it's amazing. I have no words to, you know, I can't put it in any kind of words. It's just crazy. It amazes.
Yeah, that's what I say. Until we get ready, to, there's only one thing they respect. We done been through it long enough. We know what they respect and what they don't respect. Mm-hmm. If you ain't got no type of mic, you know, they really don't respect you. So,
right.
Unfortunately, that's the way it is. So.
Well, I mean, that's the way it is. Yeah, you're right. You're right.
So what's the show about tonight, bro? What's the show about?
I'm doing on Tuskegee Airmen. Excuse me. I'm getting over a cold, so that's why my throat is still bugging me. Doing it on Tuskegee Airmen. I don't know if you heard the open of the show. One of my cousins, he worked with the Park Service. He actually worked at the museum in Birmingham, Alabama. He died a year ago yesterday. And last conversation I had with him, I was going to have him on the show, and we were going to, you know, we were going to talk about this because he was in the anniversary of the Selma March. So he did that. Matter of fact, he walked the entire march to Selma, and I was going to have him on and talk about it, but unfortunately he got sick and he died. And so there was a long, you know, I was grappling with this for the longest because I was going to do the show on this, but it just didn't seem to me to be the right time to do it. And yesterday was a year anniversary that he died, so I decided I was going to do it tonight and dedicate the show to him, even though, you know, he wasn't able to come on and talk about it. You know, I thought that I would dedicate tonight's show to him because, you know, we were going to talk about it, and he was down there. He worked at the museum, and he was, you know, he had a really, really good knowledge about all that, you know, anything about the airmen, he was expert on. He knew about all of that. So I was going to have him on and, you know, I'll pick his brain and, you know, get that information from him. But unfortunately, it didn't work out that way. So I'm going to try to do my best to, you know, to talk about him tonight. I think he would have done a whole lot better job than I'm doing. But, you know, it is what it is. It is what it is.
Yeah. All right, bro. Well, I'll go back on mute and check out the rest of the show.
All right. I appreciate you calling. Thank you.
Okay. Yes, sir. Yep.
Thank you. So this next clip I'm going to play, I don't know if you can hear that in the background. My granddaughter is having a fit, so I don't know if you can hear that. This next clip I'm going to play, this is the clip I was talking about earlier in the show. This is actually a 1945 clip entitled Wings for This Man, and it's narrated by former California governor, former president of the United States, Ronald Reagan. And this is one of those, what do you call it, news clips that they used to do back in the day at the doing the movies at the movie theaters. And it's a nice clip. It's a nice, you know, kind of like I don't think they called it a shout out. I think it's a pretty good clip on the airmen. So we're going to play this and be right back.
Morning, 20 miles from the enemy. These are American boys going to work. The morning fighter patrol. They're flying over Italy, and there are others like them flying over Burma, over the coast of Holland, over China, and over Germany. In search of the enemy. Enemy planes. The odds are bad this morning. Nearly 3-1. routine morning patrol goes on. They close the range. 3,500 feet. 3,000. 2,500. 2,000. The odds are still 3-1. But it's three Nazis spinning down in blood and flame to every one of ours. Routine morning patrol. They're good planes, wonderful planes. And their pilots are good, too. Listen.
Yesterday, I fulfilled one of my ambitions as a combat pilot. I got one airplane. And
an American far from home, fighting a war around the world. Listen again.
This was my leader, and the second ship was me, and two Focke-Wulfs came on my right. I turned right and put up a stone wall of bullets, and the first...
A wall of bullets. It wasn't so long ago these men were students in a university, workmen in a shipyard, just plain citizens from everywhere USA. They changed jobs, they changed clothes. They took a train into the future. They didn't know what the future would be, but many hoped they'd get the chance to fly and fight in the air. Some wanted that chance more than anything in the world. Deep inside Alabama is a famous school called the Tuskegee Institute. It was founded on July 4th of 1881. And since that Independence Day, it has graduated many thousands into agriculture, into science, into industry. This school was the first of its kind, and its founder, Booker T. Washington, was a pioneer who broke open a road for others to follow. This man had a dream, and the dream became stone. He lifted the veil of ignorance from his people and pointed the way to progress through education and industry. Close to this school, close to the work this man had done, the United States government determined to build an airfield. 3 years ago, this was just another farm in Alabama. More than trees had to be cleared away. There was misunderstanding and distrust and prejudice to be cleared away. 3 years ago, there was only an idea. But ideas are powerful things. And today, there are fighter planes flying overhead. Instead of swamp and yellow pine, there are hangars, repair shops, barracks. Instead of patches of corn, concrete flight strips. But that's not enough. You can't make a fighter squadron out of concrete and aluminum and a can of paint. It takes men. A chemistry student, a welder, a shoe salesman must learn how to fly. A group of average Americans must become a team of fighting men with wings. There's a new world up here. A man has to learn his way around. It takes many weeks of learning to make a fighter pilot. And a lot of that learning is done in a hard wooden chair. Because a fighter pilot is a combination of a mathematician and an athlete, a scientist and a sharpshooter. He's got to know what goes on inside his plane. The heart of his fighter is steel and copper. Its bloodstream is gas and oil. But its brain is the man who flies it. He begins in a safe, slow plane, two wings instead of one. But he flies many hours inside a closed room. In the morning, he may be flying a prescribed course over a sheet of paper. In the afternoon, he may fly the same course above the clouds. He trains his muscles down here very close to the ground, but he'll use the same sense of balance and coordination in the skies above Tuskegee. For this job of flying is never easy, and sometimes it's very, very tough. But he's learning how high and how fast and how far he must go to reach the enemy. Pilotage, dead reckoning, theory of flight, radio code. Yes, he's getting muscles in his mind. He's getting hard.
keen, quick. He's coming into the clear. Here above the warm, familiar hills of Alabama, these Americans are learning to fly in those tight combat formations they'll use someday to hunt down the German and Jap above his own cities. In addition to fighter groups, a year ago this field began to train men for medium bombers. And that too was a pioneer step. But one thing it proved, you can't judge a man here by the color of his eyes or the shape of his nose. On the flight strip, you judge a man by the way he flies. Here's the answer to Adolf and Hirohito. Here's the answer to the propaganda of the Japs and Nazis. Here's the answer, wings for this man. Here's the answer, wings for these Americans. Squadron after squadron out of Tuskegee, flying P-40s first, tough little planes, then striking with Thunderbolts, P-47s, then riding the Mustangs, P-51s. No, it was never easy for these men. They were pioneers, and no pioneer has it easy. They fought lies, they fought heartbreak, and they won. Now they fight the enemy on his own soil. They fought the enemy, not without loss. Out of the first class to graduate almost 3 years ago, only a handful are left alive, so that liberty might not perish from the earth. 3 years have passed since the founding of Tuskegee Airfield. 750 pilots have been trained. 50% of them have been in combat. And this is only a beginning. Listen to Major General Butler at the celebration of this third anniversary.
Here, for the first time, Negro aviation cadets were being groomed to fly warplanes of a unit which was then a unit in thought only, the 99th Pursuit Squadron. These men were pioneers of a venture so new that you who stand here before me now, after 3 years, may still be considered forerunners in the movement which has given you a place in the fighting men of the sky.
Under the feet of these men, a new road is being beaten out, broad enough now for thousands and ten thousands, a good road for our country. These men remember that, marching or flying. They remember backing them up, their families, their friends, who expect so much of them. And backing them up, the men and women of every creed and speech and color who made these planes. And backing them up, the most powerful force in the world, the strength of the American people.
Okay. That was a pretty interesting clip. Narrator, pretty interesting. Ronald Reagan did that. And the last clip I'm going to play tonight is entitled Tuskegee Airmen Living Legacy.
Well, at Tuskegee, I never went into town except when I got there and when I left. Things were not very conducive for, around town. I know a friend of mine who came there from New York, and he said he had his clothes on his back, and policeman asked him, what are you doing here? He said, well, I'm waiting for transportation at Tuskegee. And he told him, well, you better not be here when I come back by. So he walked all the way to Tuskegee to the institute there.
We knew that we were in a foreign land, in our own land. So what we did, we stayed on base most of the time. Because, see, our instructors, though they're white, They were good instructors. But at night, they moved off base. And at night, the base belonged to the black man. A lot of people don't know that. And when they came back, we were integrated.
I could be trained because I had been a farmer all the time, and this was the way out, you see. And that was one of the most memorable occasions for me to have been at Tuskegee and to have known at the time that there to met George Washington Carver, as I said, and just to have been at this, it was one of the pristine universities that it was an institution at that time, see, that the blacks could attend. So it was just marvelous for me.
I enjoyed it for the most part, although, as I say, it was 9 months of very hard work to get through the program.
The 12 months that I spent at Tuskegee was part of probably the most enjoyable 12 months of my military career. It was exciting. It was interesting. I knew nothing about airplanes. I'd never been in an airplane. The instructor said, this is the front and this is the back. I said, okay, if you say so, it's all right with me.
On a training flight, I flew up to Pittsburgh, the Golden Triangle, down the Ohio River, and then across the Allegheny Country Club and came down at treetop level and frightened everybody off the golf course, and they threw the clubs under the trees and dived under. It sticks in my mind because my brother at the time wanted to do some caddying out there, and they wouldn't permit blacks to even caddy there.
You know, the planes fly like your fingers. Let's say there were four of them. And there's a leader, which would have been Trezil, and then the wingmen, and the other two. And so they all fly off of that wingman. And I think he just got disoriented, and he just flew that whole flight into the ocean. And one of the guys, Jefferson, was one of my best friends, too. So it was a very, very sad day, one that you'll never forget, really.
I can guarantee you from the time I enlisted in April of 1941, and even those who were in the civil pilot training program before that, by the time the military became involved, were well aware, and throughout that entire period, that everything they did had a reflection on the black population of America.
It was an experiment no one wanted to try. It was a program designed to fail. Indeed, it was bold. An effort to leapfrog generations of segregation in the U.S. military, which had relegated most African Americans to servile roles. But despite a deck stacked against them, these people succeeded. Despite hostility, prejudice, and insult, they flew. They flew against the Germans in North Africa, in Sicily, at Anzio, and up the peninsula. They flew well, they fought hard, they died and were decorated. The Germans called them Black Birdmen. We called them the Tuskegee Airmen. Here at UCR, the Tomas Rivera Library houses the Western Archive of the Tuskegee Airmen, a growing repository of artifacts, photos, and documents recording the legacy of the Tuskegee Airmen, gentlemen and women who today, though as individual as can be, are united in their belief in the salutary effects their achievements have and will continue to have on each new generation.
As I look at the wealth of the materials in this archive, so beautifully arranged for our viewing this evening, I'm reminded that each collection represents an amazing and particular life story. A life story that will inspire and motivate our diverse student body now and in the future.
I think these archives are wonderful. I mean, I think but I want the youngsters to see them. I want these kids to see this. And I want them to know that this can be done. I would like for everyone who come to know the contribution made by black people in World War II in aviation. I think that this would be an inspiration to the generation of kids to come along. Not only the black, but the white as well.
And I'd been a part of a number of affairs at March Air Force Base, but I had no idea that UC Riverside was considering anything of that nature. And when I read about it, learned about it, that's why I'm here now. I was very, very pleased and elated.
I think it was, first of all, it's very important to have some place to have these things that are protected and that will survive. And so it's extremely important. And we're very pleased that you're going to do that.
You know, I'm really proud to see this. I expect this archive to become preeminent in its collection and exhibits and the attractiveness to the public. Historically, it really means a lot to those of us who have had some of this experience. I have some things myself that I'm going to send over. I didn't know what to do with them. Now I know. They'll come here and they will always be.
I just believe that by establishing the archive, a lot of people will be able to come in and see some of the artifacts from Tuskegee and listen to or read some of the things that they've had to say. You know, the history books, they're fine, but just reading about something, it's a lot different from hearing someone talk about it and their personal feelings, how they felt about it.
I think it will help to maintain the legacy, help to have anybody understand a little bit more what actually occurred during the war and what has happened since the war.
They are, arguably, the greatest of that greatest generation, for they fought and they won against Germany in the European theater. And they fought and they won against prejudice and insult here at home. Two fronts, two victories. The Tuskegee Airmen and Women, an achievement without parallel, and one that, thanks to them, will never need repeating.
Okay, that was the last clip. See if I can get this other clip to work that I want it to work. See if I can do a little something here. It's not gonna. For some reason I didn't download the entire clip. Which sucks. Let's see. Oops, it's not gonna. No, it's not gonna work. Well, that sucks. So, what I'm going to do, since that clip, it was a pretty decent clip, and it would have probably taken me up until closer to 10, I'm going to go ahead and end the show a little early. But I'll say this, if you want to get more information, if you want to get more information about the Airmen, please get online and look them up. Like I said, they've got movies that were made about them. They've got books. research the topics that I talk about. I mean, I always say that at the end of every show, you know, please feel free to research, read about, read a little bit more about what they did. Because like I said, sometimes I can't go through everything, but you know, you can whenever you get the opportunity to do so. So please do so. Like I said, you know, they had to fight a front on two sides. Not only did they had to fight the enemy across overseas, they had to fight the enemy here. There were people here that didn't think these men could do the job that they did. They did one hell of a job. So I give them their props. I like to end the show, like I said. You know, I had my cousin Tim T. here doing the show with me, I'm sure the show would have been, you know, a whole lot better, you know. But he's not here, but it's all good. It's all good. I'll be able to get with him one day and talk about stuff like we always used to do. So tonight's show is dedicated to his memory. I hope he enjoyed it. I'm sure he heard me. And I hope everybody listening, I hope you got something out of it also. I'll be back next week with another topic. Thank you for listening. See you next week.